Yeah. 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 Supposed to record him.
I am recording him on an MP3.
Right now?
Yeah.
Oh. Did you get last week?
Yeah. No, but hopefully the video
can. Is that I'm not going to talk about his politics, and I'm not going to talk about his ideas regarding the land of Israel, except as what he expressed to me. And I'm not going to talk about Satmar Chassidus. That's not the nature of these lectures. The nature of the lectures is really a personal story. It's my story of how I interacted with these people. And I don't want anyone to leave here and say Rabbi Wein is a Satmar Chassid. And I don't want anybody to leave here and say that Rabbi Wein is not a Satmar Chassid. I'm not talking about any of that. I'm merely telling you a story about my acquaintanceship with the Satmar Rav over a 10-year span. Now, as I mentioned, I was the Rav in Miami Beach. And in my shul, which was, when I came there, a very small shul, we were 39 families, I was the Satmar Rav. The reason that he told me his whole story about being elected is because I was elected by an overwhelming vote of 20-19. And so he knew about that. By the time he had come to Miami Beach, the 19 people were also on my side, though I had lost some of the 20, but it was never a sense of tension in our shul. It never was a question regarding the Rav and the Balabatim. We never had any of that. But he told me that that's how he got elected, so that one should not be astounded if you don't get a unanimous vote, or you don't get the vote of an overwhelming majority. As he put it, he said, one vote is good enough. So in this shul, we had a wonderful combination of people. But the people who ran the shul were Hungarians. I always used to say that was the best of all worlds. They had a Lithuanian rabbi and Hungarian Balabatim. If it were the reverse, we would have had troubles. But the Hungarians knew how to treat a rabbi, and they were wonderful to us, to my wife and to my children, to us. But the main people in the shul, especially the main money people in the shul, were all Hungarian, not of Hungarian extraction, Hungarians. They went through the Holocaust in Hungary. And like all good Zionists, they ended up in Miami Beach. And there was a Jew in shul by the name of Moskowitz, Al Moskowitz, Zichrono Livracha. Now Moskowitz's father, Feish Moskowitz, who lived in Sao Paulo in Brazil, was one of the wealthiest Jews. He had international trading all over the world. They were grain traders all over the world at a time when there were many countries as today that could not be self-sufficient. They had to import grain, and they had contracts with the American government. They had contracts with shipping. They had contracts with farmers. It was a tremendous business. Now, Feish Moskowitz was a devotee of the Satmar Rebbe, of the Satmar Rav. And in fact, when the Satmar Rav would come to Miami Beach, he would fly up from Brazil in order to, and he was already a man in his 90s. And his son, Al Moskowitz, owned a great mansion on the bay of Miami Beach. And when the Rav came to Miami Beach, Moskowitz moved out of his mansion and gave it over to the Satmar Rav, that would be where he would stay. And the Satmar Rav traveled with a tremendous entourage. Hundreds of Chassidim came down with him. Rebbes, all the, and I don't want to be misunderstood, but like all the minor league Rebbes, everybody came down with him.
so that when they came, so you needed tremendous grounds and you needed a tremendous house. Now Moskowitz, as a hobby, raised greyhound racing dogs, which is what every, you know, Jew looks forward to. And he used to have those dogs in his premises, such that, you know, it was Meshulach proof, because, you know, there was nobody that could get within 50 yards of the fence without these enormous dogs. I remember whenever I had to go over, I would always call them and I'd say, yeah, I'll get rid of them, right? You know, I don't want to meet them. And he raised these racing dogs, the greyhounds. He had to get rid of the greyhounds when the Rav came too. Put them in kennels. It was a whole thing. You know, and it was like weeks of preparation. The Satmar Rav is coming. The Satmar Rav is coming. I was scared stiff of the Satmar Rav. I never had, had any contact with anyone like that. And he had a reputation that frightened people. And especially his political views, his extreme anti-Zionism, his almost doctrinaire opposition to the state of Israel. So I figured, you know, he'll come, he'll stay by Moskowitz. What do I, you know, nothing, I, nothing to do with me. I had other Hungarian Balabatim and Shul. It was an interesting thing, an interesting phenomena, that the Hungarian Jews that were fierce Zionists, those that were not necessarily so observant, none of them were Hasidish. When the Satmar Rav came, that was it. They all went to him and they all stayed by him and they all came for blessings. And, you know, I told the Rebbe once, in only in a joking manner, I said, if he'd stay in Miami Beach, these guys would behave themselves. So he said to me, in his joking manner, he said, but what about the guys in Brooklyn, he says. Right? If I'm here, who's going to take care of them? He never fooled himself. He never fooled himself and never let anybody fool him. He knew the score exactly. And I had had a very unpleasant experience just before he came with one of the butchers in Brooklyn there. We tried to have a butcher shop, the Rabbonim, the younger Rabbonim, and then in Miami Beach, Rabbi Lairfield and I, and Rabbi Stauber and others, Rabbi Weberman. We tried to have a butcher. We could never get a butcher. So we're always bringing meat from out of the city, which could be a solution for individual families, but certainly is not a solution for the community. And a rabbi has to worry about the community as well. Finally, we hit upon a plan that we got a butcher, and we didn't trust the butcher. The butcher was a weak Shomer Shabbos, but what with the arrangement that we made is that he would bring in only kosher-made meat already from Brooklyn. And then he could cut it up, etc. The meat was, it was all done already by the time it came to him, and he could market it. And we felt that was the best we could do, and we had every day of the week, one of the rabbis went into the butcher shop. It was all fine. One day I walked into the butcher shop, and I looked at the slab of the four-quarter of meat that had been sent, and I noticed that the veins had not been removed. It wasn't trabered. The halacha is that there are veins of blood and there are ripples of fat in the meat that have to be removed for it to be kosher. And chelev adam, the Torah says, kol chelev chol dam lo so chelu. And somehow in these four quarters it had not been done. And to make it worse, these four quarters are already soaked and salted, so now you couldn't save anything from it. So I told the butcher, I said, you know, we have a problem here because these four quarters are not, we can't sell them. I said, maybe you can get rid of them on the non-kosher market, but we can't sell them. I said, give me the phone number of the butcher there. I'm going to call him. And I called him up. And I said to him in my perfect Hungarian Yiddish that, you know, it came and somehow it must have slipped through. You made a mistake because it came without being traitored. Came without it being deveined. To which he answered me on the phone. He said, I didn't think you Lutvakis cared about those things. That's what he said to me. So I told him, listen, mister, you're not shipping in another pound of meat to Miami Beach ever. Now we have to go looking for another guy who thought that maybe Lutvakis did care. So I, that background, you know, and here comes the Satmarug, right? And I'm without a beard, without a black suit, without a black hat. So I figure I'm going to ignore the whole thing. I have a second issue. I had built, our shul had built a mikveh in the shul because the city mikveh was a very long distance away and not then in a very desirable neighborhood. And the women certainly on a Friday night or on a Yontiv night, it was in brides, etc. It was not a good situation. So we had room and got someone that sponsored it and paid for it, and we built the mikveh. And when we built the mikveh, we brought in a number of experts how to build a mikveh, and the mikveh was built. One of the things you should know is that whenever you do something, there is someone that always says, no, it's not good. It's not good. There's no Erev in the world that's been built without a fight. There's no mikveh in the world that's been built without a fight. It just, unfortunately, it's part of us. So there were people that said, you know, what kind of mikveh is this? Or the more telling question is, who is he to build a mikveh? And even though noted experts on mikvos came and looked at the mikveh and said that it was perfectly kosher and everything, but there always was this, to use a bad pun, there was this undercurrent that the mikveh somehow was not good. So the Satmarov comes to town and he moves in by Moskowitz. One day I'm sitting at home, I get a call. This is the Shamas, the Gabbai from the Satmarov. The Rav wants to come and pay you, he said, he wants to pay you an official visit. You're the Mor d'Asra? See, I was a Mor d'Asra once before also. You're the Mor d'Asra, and courtesy, rabbinic courtesy, is that he wants to pay you a visit. Wow. So you can't say, no, I'm not going to let you in the door. And Moskowitz's dogs were put away somewhere, right? So I said, when does the Rebbe, when does he want to come? And we made up a time. And sure enough, he comes with the whole entourage. He comes to my house. And he sits next to me in the dining room. And then he began to talk to me. And he says to me, I hear Ms. Maranin of a mikveh. People don't like the mikveh. So I'm trembling already. He says to me, don't worry. Daigetnit. Don't worry, he says, the mikveh, I spoke to the people that made the mikveh that you called in, it's kosher lemahadrin, and he took care of the mikveh for me. The next morning he went and was tovel in the mikveh. He came himself and he was tovel in the mikveh, and he let it be known throughout town that this is the mikveh he's using. Well, if the Satmarov is using the mikveh, so then, adverse opinions evaporated. And I was so impressed, because what does he have to stick his nose into my problems? And why did he have to come and help me? He says to me, I remember the first conversation vividly, you know. First of all, he had a face. He had an electric fluorescent bulb in his face. I never saw, in the Yiddish, they say, a lichtik upon him. I never saw a face like that in my life. Just shone. A handsome man, beard. And he had a trait. He was in the Holocaust. He was one of the 1,560 people that Kostner saved from Bergen-Belsen on the famous train that went to Switzerland. His wife and children were destroyed in the Holocaust. But he was saved. He was on that train. He never slept in a bed after the Holocaust. So what he would do is take cat naps 24 hours a day. So he would sit and talk to you, and in the middle he'd fall asleep. And you had to wait 3 minutes, 4 minutes, for never lasted more than 5 minutes. He'd wake up, he remembered exactly where you were in the conversation, he'd begin talking again. So, he was a greater than life figure. I never met anybody like that. And the man knew Kol HaTorah Kula. Whatever you talked to him about, I mean, everything he knew. And he was a tremendous darshan, a tremendous orator. He has svarim on drush that are marvelous. That many rabbis use clandestinely. So he's sitting next to me, and he says, first of all, he tells me a joke. We had a tremendous sense of humor. He says, and you have to know Yiddish for this joke, but we'll try it anyway. He says, Vos in Europe, but min gerufen a schlak, is in America a roof. Which loosely translated, and it can't be done, but a schlak was an awning, a cover, right? And a schlak in Yiddish also was a pejorative term, with an insult. So he said what in Europe was a schlak, in America is a roof, which is a play on the word, and the way he said a roof was the same thing. He says, so don't be nervous. He says, that's the way it is. And he said to me, what does a roof have to know? I said, Rebbe, I don't know, you know, you have to know, you're supposed to know Gan Shas, you're supposed to know all the Talmud, you're supposed to know all the Shulchan Aruch, you're supposed to know Dr. 999 Ploiters. That's nonsense. He says, I'll tell you a story from me. He said, I came to be the Rav in Satmar. He said, I was a young man. So the courtesy was that when in Europe, when the new Rav came to town, so all the Shochtim would bring their knives to him that he should look over the knife. That was the sign of courtesy. So he said there were like 30 Shochtim, and they all came and they presented the knife. There's one old Sheikhet that's, he didn't present the knife to him. And after everybody left, he was the only one left. He said the sheikh had reached, he had boots on. He reached into his boot and took out his chalif. And he said to him, Rebbe, I want to ask you something. He said, a shochet is supposed to review all the laws of shchita every 30 days. There's a sefer called Simlo Chadosho, which has all the laws of shchita. The Shochtim review it every 30 days. So he said, I've been a Shochet, he said, close to 40 years. He said, I know the Simcha Chadosha by heart. He said, but I review it every 30 days. He says, but I notice that when they take a Sefer Torah out of the Oren and they start the lane and there's a mistake, the Rav doesn't know what to do. So he said to him, Rebbe, Favosidos, why is that the case? So the Satmar Rav told me that that night he took out the Svarim, the Keshes HaSofer, and all the other Svarim about the halachas of a Sefer Torah and how the letters are supposed to be written. And he said he learned it, and he said it had happened the next Shabbos. There was a mistake, but he knew what to do. Right away he said what to do. So he said, the Sheikhet is doch given Elio Anovi, right? God sent me the prophet Elijah, because otherwise, you know, you go up there and you hem and haw, maybe, could be, you know, you call up a kid, you know, all sorts of, everybody's talking, and the next day, Sunday, the whole town is talking, you know, that we had a mistake in the Sefer Torah, and the Rav didn't know what to do. So he told me that story, and he stopped. So that night, I also started, for the first time, to look up things. And it didn't happen the next week, but it happened within 3 months that we had a serious problem in the Sefer Torah. And it just so happened that I had seen those halachas, and I had seen in the Mishnah Berurah how the letters were supposed to be made. And I was able, you know, on the spot to say what to do. And the people in Miami Beach thought they had a rabbi, because of the fact that he told me what a rov has to do. So he pays me this official visit. When a rov comes, he eats fruit, and it's a whole setup. I mean, the gabbai takes care of everything, sets up the chairs. It's a ritualistic dance. You have to see it, you know. And I'm from Chicago. I don't know anything about this, but it all went very well. So the next day, Moskowitz calls me up. He says, the Rav likes you. The Rav told me, he said, you have a good Rav here. You have to help him. And so now I have to pay a courtesy visit back to him, because this goes on the whole winter, you know, back and forth. But I was fascinated by him. So I told Moskowitz, okay, I'm coming over this afternoon at 4 o'clock. He said, wait, I got to clear it with the gabbai, yeah, because everything goes through the gabbai. And the gabbai clears it, and at 4 o'clock I tell him, put the dogs away. He said, there are no dogs, you know, you can come. I show up, and we sit outside. I mean, you got to see the scene. You sit outside by the boat dock, you know, in Miami Beach in February. It's 78 degrees outside, and with the tropical trees and plants. And I speak to him, and I say, Rebbe, can I ask you, you know, I said, we have a masifta here in Miami Beach, of a high school. Rabbi Rotman, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, Merkaz HaTorah, and who was the Rav in Long Beach, and originally was the Rav in Miami Beach, in my shul. I succeeded him. He founded the shul. He was the founding rabbi. And he made this high school. It was a little high school. We never had more than 35 students. But out of this high school came, we have Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbonim, wonderful Balabatim. The high school did a great deal for Miami Beach, even though in numbers it was insignificant. In order to strengthen the morale of the students in the high school, because nobody likes to be in a high school with 25, 30 students. Of whom 80%, are non-athletic. And the other 20% don't want to be there. So it's always a question of somehow building up their morale. So the method that Rabbi Gross, Zichrona Livracha, and I used was that whenever there was a guest in town, we would bring him to the Masifta. So Rabbi Yankiv came to the Masifta, Rabbi Meshe Feinstein came to the Masifta. Great people came to the Masifta, and they came and they talked, and they, you know, and visiting rabbis came to the Masifta. And David Lifshitz came to the Masifta. It was Rabbi Mordechai Shulman, the Slabodka Rosh Yeshiva, came to the Masifta, Rav Tukachinsky from Yeshiva Seitz Chaim here in Yerushalayim. So it was always, you know, so they felt a sense of excitement, and all the Rabbonim tried to encourage them and tell them, you know, and it really helped. So I really took the chance of my lifetime, and I said, Rebbe, maybe, you know, maybe you'd come to the Masifta. So he looks at me, he never answers directly, tells you a story. He says to me, the Masifta has secular studies, he said, secular. So I said, yeah, it's a full high school, we learn till 2:30, and then the rest of the afternoon is the high school. He said, I'll tell you a story. He said, a man walks into a restaurant, and he orders a bowl of soup. The waiter brings him the soup. He looks in the soup, and there are flies in the soup. Calls over the waiter, he says, can you give me the soup separate and the flies separate? So I understood immediately that he wasn't coming to visit us. He wanted the flies separate. He didn't want it in the soup, right? He didn't want it together. And so I never pressed him again. And he told Moskowitz, he says, well, your rabbi catches on, right? The Fashteit Azach, right? We understand that I can't afford to go there, right? Because that's not going to be our thing. When he came, so there were, as I mentioned, hundreds of Hasidim came down. Now, we had the big shul in town in that neighborhood. Then there were no Shtiblach, there were no condominiums, it was a different Miami Beach. So all the Chassidim had to come daven in our shul, which I saw from the first day on was very uncomfortable for them and very uncomfortable for us. First of all, they wanted daven Nusach Svard and we were Nusach Ashkenaz. Second, it was a whole thing. They wanted to start davening at 10 and we wanted to start at 7. So I said to the Gabbai, I said, well, how would you like to have your own minion here in the shul? Oh, great idea, he said. So I said, I'll tell you what. He said, we have a big Beis Medrash here. We'll daven in the big shul. You daven in the Beis Medrash. And you do whatever you want, right? We're happy to have you. So he calls me up the Rav and he says, Azah Chochman. He said, who can daven with these guys? He says to me. He said, I have my own minion. I can't, like, I can't, you know. He said, that's the smartest thing to do. So I saw that he really appreciated my situation. And we discussed many things, community problems, general problems. I always steered away from Eretz Yisrael. Because I knew that, you know, that wasn't going to go anywhere, and I didn't want it to, you know, I didn't want to start up with them. Came the Six-Day War. So I'm sure that in the memory of those that were alive at the time of the Six-Day War, we all remember that as almost a defining moment in our lives. I remember that in the week before the Six-Day War began, when the Jewish world was in terror as to what was going to happen, and the Arab world said, you know, now we're going to destroy them, we're going to throw them into the sea, and the whole world stood by and did nothing. So I remember that every day, hundreds of people came to our synagogue and just sat. Well, all sorts of people, people I never saw before in the synagogue and never saw afterwards. But you didn't know what to do. You did not know what to do. I remember that we were told by the rabbinic organization that we should go see our Christian ministers in the neighborhood if they would write a letter to the president, we all thought Lyndon Johnson was going to do something else. So I remember I went to the minister of the big church in the neighborhood, and he told me straight out, he said, that's not our concern. Which to me also gave me an insight into people. And I think that to a great extent, it's still not their concern. If Iran would have threatened to blow France off the map, by now they would have done something. But it's only Israel, so, you know, we're going to do it diplomatically. In any event, the Six-Day War occurs. It was a Wednesday afternoon. I'm driving my car in Miami Beach. Miami Beach was a pretty Jewish town. And the news flash comes across that that Tzahal had recaptured Yerushalayim, and they had Rabbi Goren blowing the shofar, etc. So cars stopped in the middle of the street. People got out of the car and embraced each other, strangers. I felt up Mashiach kum. I remember I got out of the car, I saw an old Jew, Mr. Shamitz. I told it to him, so Shamitz said, like Yaakov Avinu, he said, Omuso apam, he said, now I can go in peace. Jerusalem is ours again. It was an electric moment. And like most of those moments, they're very hard to recapture. So when the Rav came down the next winter, and people were, my wife and I had made our first trip to Eretz Yisrael then, and we were still in the euphoria of the time. So when he came down and he paid us the official visit, he said to me, what do you say about Eretz Yisrael? So I said, I just say, Chazal say everything there is to say about Eretz Yisrael. What can I add, right? The rabbis extolled all of its virtues. He said, nay, I don't mean that. You know what I mean. So I said, they're building a Jewish state, and it's a refuge for Jews. I don't know what banalities I said to him. He said, I want to tell you one thing, he said, you should remember it. And this is the only time he ever spoke to me. He said, all of them will eventually, he said, give up on the state, on the land, and on the people. And that was, I never discussed it with him again, and he never discussed it with me again. But that's what he said. So, we filed that away. When we were sitting there talking about it, so there was a chassid that had also just come back from Eretz Yisrael. Now, Satmar Rav wrote a book on the Six-Day War called Alagula Valatmura, which is a bitterly anti-Zionist tract, stronger even than his first book, than Vayoel Moshe. I imagine that he did it simply because of the euphoria, and I imagine he was afraid that even his camp would follow it, and so he took a lot of heat for it. In any event, this Jew that went there to Israel, the Satmar Chosid, he's sitting at the table too, and he says, you know, I went there to Israel, and they showed me Kever Shmuel Anovi. And he said, well, he said, they're liars, Shmuel HaNovi. What do they know where Shmuel HaNovi is buried, right? It's all a fake, you know, it's all, you know, he starts out with him. So the Rav looks at him and he says, I don't know if he's there or not, but one thing is for sure, he's not in Brooklyn. And that, like, you know, put an end to the conversation. He was officially the Rav of the Eidah Haredis here in Yerushalayim. And he encouraged his chassidim to come to Eretz Yisrael. There are a lot of Satmar chassidim in Eretz Yisrael, and a lot of Satmar Mozdos here in Eretz Yisrael, especially in Yerushalayim, and they pumped in millions. But they're extraterritorial. They have nothing to do with the state. It's a very strange relationship. So I remember that same year, Rav Gorin came to Miami Beach. That's before he was the chief rabbi. He was still the chaplain, chief chaplain of the Israeli army. Now Rav Gorin, to put it mildly, was outspoken. You never doubted where he stood on any matter. And he came to our shul. So I remember in our shul there were people who didn't stand for one reason or another for the Tehillim on behalf of Eretz Yisrael, etc., for whatever reason, which I never, Rabbi Yaakov told me that's not an issue, and I never made an issue out of it. Rav Gorin gets up in shul, walks over to the bima, pushes the president aside, and he says, "Everybody stand!" And he says it like a general, right? Like, "Attention! Everybody stand!" And he does the prayer for the Medina. That's not enough. He says, "Everybody keep on standing." And he does the prayer for Tzahal. That's not enough. I know he had six prayers. So later he came to our house for Kiddush. So the Hungarian Balabat, we invited the people from the shul, you know, to have Kiddush with our guests, etc. And the Hungarian Balabatim wanted to pull him a little. So they said, you know, the Satmarov's in town. Maybe you'll go see him. We'll arrange, you know, you can go see him. He exploded. I don't want to repeat the words that he said. He just exploded like a volcano. When it was over, when he was leaving, he said he shouldn't have done it. He said, the Satmarov's a Talmud Chacham, he shouldn't have done it. But he said, if you're in the Israeli army, he told me, Rav Gorin, if you're in the Israeli army and you've seen Jewish boys die for Eretz Yisrael, he said, then, you know, I can't take it. He said, you can take it here in the Golis. So, needless to say, Rav Gorin didn't go to see him, and he didn't go to see Rav Gorin. When I left Miami Beach, so then, as I mentioned, I became the head of kashrus for the OU. So that's my next meeting with him, but a completely different context. Because his philosophy, which he expressed to me many times, he says, by me they learn until they're 16 years old. After that, they go to work. He says, there are a few that we keep in the kollel. There's a few that we keep, you know, so blind by learning. And most of them, out. So in New York, the electronics, the retail electronics industry is theirs. They're in the Diamond District. They're in all sorts of businesses. Real estate, mortgages. And the same thing is true in England. Some of the largest mortgage companies in England, home mortgage companies, are Satmar Chassidim, who have proper English gentlemen as the front, but it's their company and they're the ones to make the decisions and run it. And that was his policy. He used to say, "Mizol mir nit fauten." They shouldn't fool me. They're learning. If they can learn, then they can stay. But if they can't learn, who needs them in the base medrash? Let them go out and make a living. Which is not the hashkafa, not the view of, for instance, the Lithuanian yeshivas, where everybody was supposed to be in learning and that it was open-ended. I always recount Rabbi Leff's story that he told me, Rabbi Zev Leff, who, by the way, is a graduate of the Miami Masifta. I knew him when he was Billy. He told me once that he met a student of his on the street, former student of his on the street, the student of his yeshiva here in Israel, and he said to him, Nehemiah, how are you doing? So the boy answered him, Rebbe, I'm not learning anymore, but don't worry, I'm not working. Which is pretty expressive of an attitude, right? But by him, by the Satmarov, the attitude was just the opposite. If you're not in the yeshiva learning, then why aren't you working? They have a tremendous trucking industry. It's really a society. In any event, one of the industries that they made was in kashrus. It was called Heimish, Chassidish. Why should you buy Procter & Gamble? Or why should you buy Procter & Gamble oil or Mazola when you can buy Narola? Narola was a Chassidish company in New York. The only thing is that Narola bought all the oil from Mazola. Because there's no place, they don't have their own oil factory. But, that's the way it was. And Rabbi Rosenberger, bless in memory, allowed this to happen. As I mentioned when I spoke about him, that he had a very soft spot for all the Nitzolei HaShoah, for all the European Jews. So he looked away from a lot of things that they did. Well, I'm the head of the OU, so many times things happened, and the kashrus committee of the OU would object. They would say, these guys are living off of us, right? And, we got to stop it. We got to kick them out of the plant. Don't allow them in the plant. And I always felt that if Rabbi Rosenberg allowed them in the plant, why should I stop them from being in the plant? Especially since it didn't seem to, it gave them parnosa, it gave them a way of making a living. And if people wanted to pay for it and buy it, etc. So to the Satmarov, I remember there was a big fight about beech nut baby food. Beech nut baby food was under the OU. We controlled the plant. So the Chassidim came to me and they said they want to make kosher baby food in beech nut. So I told them beech nut already is making kosher baby. What do you want there? So they said all sorts of stories, that we don't kosher the machinery, all really untruths. I said, it's ridiculous, I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go to the Satmarov. Let's go together and we'll see what happens. Whatever he says. So that's an offer they couldn't refuse. We went to the Satmarov. I remember it was like 12:30 at night. We had the appointment, and he's sitting there in the chair. Oh, Rabbi Vine, how are you? So I tell him, Rebbe, we have a problem. And so first they said all of these things, Linas Lila, we don't kosher, we don't do this, we don't do that. And I said, all of that is untrue. We do all of these things. If it's 100% kosher, it's lama. It's a mahadrin. I don't know any problems that can be in baby food. There's no fleishiks. We don't. The only fleishik of baby food was made by Manashevitz in a separate plant. So I said, it's squash and corn and peas. What are you talking about? So he says to them, Kaita Royce kicks them all out of the room. And he says to me, he says, these guys are poor guys. They have to have a parnusa. He said, I'm looking for years to find them a job. What they can do. They can't do anything. He says to me, the only thing they're good for is kosher baby food. That's what he says to me. That's what they're good for. It's the Lord's leaven, he said. Let it be. What do you care? So I said, Rebbe, but I got the manegin of Balabatim, and I got the Rabbonim, and I got, you know, like it's, I'm not the owner of the thing, right? So he said, well, you know what we'll do? We will package the beech nut baby food with our labels and sell them. So you don't need them in your plant. It's like a private label. He knew everything. He knew the whole business. He knew everything. And that's what we'll do. So I went back to the Kashrus Commissioner, I remember. And I said, you know, he's no different than Pathmark or Kroger or A&P, you know, that all private label their products in this same plant. It's all the same baby food. And we let it go. And he had the shamus, he had his gabbai call me and tell me, he said, you know, he said, in his inimitable fashion, he said, oh you, oh yes, oh no, wer weiß auch der, aber ihnen haben Parnusse. Right, Jews have a living from it, he said, so that's what you have to worry about. You have to worry that they should have a living. You don't have to worry about, you know, he used to say, oh you, oh yes, oh no, oh this, wer weiß auch der. And that really was his idea. A year after I moved to New York, he suffered a stroke, Rachmana Vaslan. And it was like a severe stroke. So that when I went to visit him, you know, I couldn't understand him anymore. And I don't know if he understood me. But you always have people around, you know, that interpret. It was the same thing happened with other great men. And the people who are around interpret it many times for their benefit. You don't really know, I was walking out, I remember on a matter I didn't even ask him, and I walked out, and the gabbai, whom I knew very well by now, said to me, well, just tell me what the problem is, and I'll communicate it with him, and I'll tell it back to you. So I said to him, Rabbi Yosef, if I wanted to do that, I would have asked you directly. I would have come to you. I said, I can't deal that way. And especially on what was always a problem. Satmar Rav told me, he said, when he came to America, he said he didn't have a minyan in Williamsburg. You have to daven by the spinker. And today there are, it's estimated that there are over 50,000 Satmar Lehi Nora in the New York area. And they have their own village. But he was a person that, so to speak, the Gemara says that when Rav died, Abba Aricha, when he died, so when they told Shmuel that Rav died, he said, Oy vey, inish de mistafinim inay. The one man that I was afraid of is no longer here. So I'm not afraid of anybody. I can do what I want. Oy vey, he said. The Satmar Rav was inish de mistafinim inay. Everybody was afraid of him. The Lutvakas were afraid of him. The Rashi Yeshiva were afraid of him. The other Rebbes were afraid of him. The Chassidim were afraid of him. And therefore, he, so to speak, held it in check. He held it, he held it so that there were boundaries. There were things that could be done and things that couldn't be done. And he had a profound influence in that fashion on the entire Orthodox Jewish community. And since then, I don't think there's been such a person in the Hasidic world, at least in the United States. There hasn't been an inish to Mr. Finemene, a person that we should stand in awe and fear and fright, that to be able to control the matter. And in that respect, then, his demise was a great loss. And since then, Satmar itself has had many splits within it. Many, many different things have occurred. But it's a remarkable testimony to the person of what one person was able to do with his willpower, just pure willpower. He told me once, he said, they told me that when I come to America, I have to learn English. So he told me a funny story. He had a story for everything. He said, we have a new butcher in Williamsburg that my Bezdin gave a hechsher to. He's an Erlich Eid, wonderful butcher shop. Nobody buys by it. So he said, I had the Rebbetzin call in the ladies and ask them, how come you don't buy by this butcher? And they said, he's not kosher. He doesn't speak Hungarian. So he said to me, he said, so it's enough, he said, azichob Ungarish. I don't need English, too, he said. It's enough. It's enough. And the strength of what he accomplished, both in Israel and here, is not to be diminished. His philosophy, his view, most of the Jewish world disagrees with it till today. Most of the Torah world disagrees with it until today. But my experiences with him as a person, and as a person who helped me, and not just me, but who helped the young Rav, whom he could have ignored, and worse than that, he could have crushed. And there are many people that want to crush others. And he went out of his way to help and to strengthen and to build up one's morale. So I'm eternally grateful that I had the opportunity to know him and the impression that he made upon me and that he made upon my community. I want to thank you all for coming to these lectures. I hope you've enjoyed them as much as I've enjoyed discussing them. And Emir Tzeshem, in the springtime, we will have another series of lectures. I hope that you'll be able to attend those as well. There's a minyan for Myra. Thank you. How are you? Not that much. Not that
much. I'm Albert Tana. You remember that I met you at the Gula Convention.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that when I'm still trying to encourage everybody to make sure they have term life insurance here and in Israel and everything. And I know you're a big advocate of that, so I just wanted to tell you that I've been going to all the Gedolim again. Like, Litvish, Hasidish, Misnagdish.
Yeah, that they should do it.
That they should do it. And I'm having Brooks and Bells came out with a Pesach Din.
Good.
And it's starting to take effect.
Good. That's when I walked a little bit. I have a question.